Les colloques du Collège de France.
So it's a great pleasure to welcome you at this conference entitled The Economics of Artificial Intelligence. It was jointly organized by the RCEA, the Rimini Center for Economic Analysis. Is that the and the Innovation Lab at Collège de France. So the organizers were Antonin Bergeau and Alessandro Riboni. And this has been supported by High Paris, this conference, and CEPR. And voilà, and the program, and me, I'm totally not... I'm consumer there. You are the producers. I will producer of one, two. So I give the floor to Antonin, and we will detail the conference.
Thank you. So just a very quick word of housekeeping. So the presentations are going to be allocated 30 minutes in total. So have you seen the conference is going to be in English? Because we have many non-French speakers. So you have 30 minutes in total, so please keep the presentation below 25 minutes, and then we will have a few 5 minutes for Q&A at the end. The first speaker is Roland. I'm not sure I've seen him. So that's a good start. So Eduardo, I don't know if you mind the switching and maybe start. Are you okay? Thanks very much. So the floor is yours. I'll let you know when you have an attendee.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you so much, Antonin, for and all the organizers for having me. I'm very, very excited to be here. I'll be presenting joint work with Enrique Ide. We're both assistant professors at ESA Business School in Barcelona. And this is part of a bigger research agenda that I wanted to start talking to you about. So this research has been taking me quite a bit to San Francisco. And if you walk around San Francisco these days, you'll see billboards like this, saying something like humans are so 2023, hire an AI business developer representative, right? So there seems to be a lot of interest in developing these AI systems that can actually replace human in all sorts of kinds of knowledge work. And that raises the natural question, what are the implications of this for labor markets, right? And this is part of the agenda we're pursuing with Enrique. And the first question I think that has to be asked when you're asking this question is, how is AI different from previous automation technologies, right? And that's a question we've been struggling with. And in the end, we found this idea of the importance of knowledge that is codifiable versus non-codifiable. And one of the main things that is new about AI that we think is a big deal is that AI can actually start doing things that are non-codifiable, okay? And this is a complete contrast to previous automation technologies. So we've sort of summarized this idea in this little table that we have manual work and cognitive work on the vertical axis, and then we have codifiable, non-codifiable, and AI, we're going to be seeing it as an automation technology that can do cognitive work, but that is non-codifiable, and that sets it apart from all previous automation technologies that would do cognitive work. So the idea that AI can do cognitive work is not new. We've had such technologies for a long time. What is new about AI from our point of view is that AI can do cognitive work that is actually non-codifiable. And the idea of codifiability is things that require that you can put the knowledge into a certain list or a certain algorithm. You can specify how you do things. You can write it down. You can write it down in a book or in an algorithm. Non-codifiable knowledge is the idea that there are certain things we know how to do, but we don't know how to explain how to do. The standard example is riding a bicycle. Most of us know how to ride a bicycle, but if you have to write a book about how to ride a bicycle, it's going to be very hard, right? So we learn via trial and error. And the thing that is new about AI is that because we train it via examples, essentially, it can actually start doing things that we just don't know how to codify. That's the main difference relative to other automation technologies. And then there's the traditional automation, which is sort of manual codifiable work. And in the future, there's there's ideas of combining these AI systems with traditional robots to create what is usually called physical AI. But we're not there yet, so we'll be staying in the cognitive non-codifiable back at for now. So this is actually, we're not the first to realize this, but where we think we're contributing is to understanding why is this difference important? Why would this make a big deal? And the observation is that we've had a long literature for at least 20 years, and if not for more years, making the point essentially that non-codified knowledge is actually a major economic bottleneck. Okay, what's the idea here? The fact that knowledge is non-codifiable, a lot of the useful knowledge in production is non-codifiable, implies that it's embodied in individuals and it's hard to transfer, because if you cannot write down what you know, then only you can produce based on your knowledge, right? So the use of this very valuable knowledge, which is non-codifiable, is actually constrained by the time of the humans who have that knowledge. And as a result, there's a key role of organizations in society to make the best possible use of this knowledge. And how is that going to happen? It's going to by organizing communication. So who tackles problems first, who asks whom, and there's a whole problem of organizational design that is essentially the main role of organizations from this point of view is to think, okay, how should we use the time of those who know most in the most optimal way? So who are these guys who know the most are going to be communicating, and what kind of problems they're going to receive, right? So there's this whole literature, and the observation is, well, if AI can actually start doing non-codifiable knowledge work, it's essentially automating this bottleneck. That should make a big difference. It should lead to a reorganization in society if this is a big part of why organizations exist, right? So the sort of key idea behind the research agenda is that machines may be using AI, and this idea of AI being able to do non-codifiable work, this may allow machines to play a big part in modern organizations, right? And we've written a couple of papers already on this. The first one is forthcoming at the JPE. It's essentially a closed economy. Then we've essentially extended that framework to an open economy, and to understand how AI, with this ability to reorganize organizations, can affect offshoring and the global economy. This is forthcoming in the Journal of Monetary Economics. And today, I want to sort of show you the next paper we're writing about this, which is we're going to be tackling a couple of limitations of this previous work that we've been doing. The first one is that all the literature and our own work included has been focusing on unidimensional knowledge. And when we talk about AI, it's very natural to start thinking, well, but AI might be very good in some things relative to humans, very bad in other things relative to humans. So we want to allow for that possibility. As a result, we're going to be extending the model to multidimensional knowledge instead of the unidimensional assumption that has been in the literature for a long time. And again, the idea is that once you think about AI, probably the idea of having different dimensions and AI being very good in some and not so good in others is important. And the other one, another limitation of this previous work is that we've been focusing on the effect of introducing AI from a pre-AI economy. And the whole idea is who are the winners and who are the losers, pre-AI, post-AI versus pre-AI. Now we want to start already with an economy that has AI in it, and we want to ask a very simple natural question, which is, what happens when AI becomes better? It's sort of probably the simplest question you can ask is, what happens when AI becomes better in one dimension? How does this affect labor income in particular? We humans interacting with machines in organizations, if AI become better, does that naturally lead to more labor income? So humans having higher wages or not? That's the kind of question we'll be asking, right? And to ask this question and answer it, we'll present a very, very, the simplest model you can think of. And it's going to be a traditional model of a knowledge economy, but with two dimensions. And the idea that knowledge is non-codifiable translates into the model in the idea that it's very important to communicate. Once a problem comes up, you may communicate with others that might know the solution if you don't know the solution, right? So communication will be central in this model. So there's going to be two factors of production. One is going to be labor, humans, which will normalize the time of humans to be one. This is going to be two-dimensional, so you have dimension one, dimension two, and humans have certain knowledge in dimension one, H1, certain knowledge in dimension two. Same thing for machines or computing power. There's going to be mu units, and we're going to think of mu being large relative to one. So there's a lot of machines relative to humans. And this, again, two-dimensional knowledge. There's going to be competitive firms, which can have one or two layers, okay? And this is the sort of the main picture I want you to have in mind. You can have firms that hire labor or machines in isolation, and they just produce by themselves if they can. You can also have two-layer firms where there is communication, and machines help humans or humans help machine in the production process, okay? I'll describe how this communication works in a second, but that's sort of the main idea. We can have organizations of machines doing the production work and asking human managers, or humans essentially doing the production work and asking machines when they're stuck. I'll be describing this in more detail in the next slide. And as a benchmark, as I said before, we'll think of mu as being large relative to one. So even if you want, there's so much computing power, so many machines, that you don't have enough human time to match all machines with humans, right? And that's going to be sort of a benchmark. Then we can relax it as well. But it makes things quite, I think it's realistic, and it makes the analysis quite simple for as a benchmark. Okay, so let me give you a little bit more detail about these organizations. So how does a single layer organization look like? Let me look at a single layer automated firm, so one that uses machines. Well, every machine will use its unit of time to pursue a particular project. Once you pursue a particular project, there's going to be a problem arising, and it's going to have two dimensions of difficulty, that knowledge. Okay, and it's going to be the distribution of this knowledge is going to be distributed according to some general distribution function. Now, the machine will be able to produce only if her knowledge in each dimension is larger than the difficulty of the problem in each dimension. So you can think of one dimension as being quantitative difficulty, the other one qualitative difficulty, and machines have a knowledge in each dimension. So in order to solve the problem, you have to have enough knowledge in both dimensions, okay? And if you are missing the knowledge in at least one of the dimensions, then you cannot produce. And if you are in a one-layer organization, that's all you can do. There's no communication allowed. The things are different in two-layer firms. Let's look at, for example, the two-layer firm that has machines in the bottom layer. Now, it's going to be the same as before. The machines will be doing exactly as above, but when they are stuck, when they face a problem they cannot solve, now they can ask the manager, which in this case is going to be a human, okay? And each question will take some units of the manager's time, right? As a result, what you can have is you can have machines that for every human manager will employ many machines, because some machines are able to produce to produce by themselves. What is the probability that each machine is going to be able to produce by themselves? It's 1 minus Fm. Fm is the probability that the machine, sorry, Fm is the probability that the machine will be able to solve the problem by itself. 1 minus Fm is the probability that the machine asks the human. Each time the machine asks will take C units of the human time, so as a result you can have these nm numbers of machine below every human manager, okay? And what this shows is that the more the machine knows, the more machines each human can have under its supervision, essentially. So the expected output here is going to be the number of machines that the firm hires times the probability that the combination of machine and human time, so MVH is going to be the maximum in both dimensions of machine and human knowledge. This is the probability that the combination of machine and human time can solve the problem times the number of machines. So that's going to be the expected output in each such organization. Okay, so you can have two-layer firms that have machines at the bottom and human managers at the top, or vice versa. Okay, and the question is, okay, which, as a function of human knowledge and machine knowledge, which organizations will be forming in this economy, and how does the rental rate of capital and the labor wage change as a result of changes in this machine knowledge? Okay, so let me give you a little bit of detail about the competitive equilibrium. It's not going to be much, and we'll be going to the main result in a minute. Okay, so the first observation is that the rental rate of capital in equilibrium, that is the price of each unit, the equilibrium price of each unit of machine time, is going to be Fm, which is the probability that the machine solves the problem by itself, right? So this comes from the idea that machine time is very large, so some machines will have to be used in isolation, and that already pins down the expected output of machines in isolation, pins down the opportunity cost of each machine. it's going to be just FM. The probability that the machine knows how to solve the problem by itself. Now, the interesting thing is what's going to happen to the equilibrium wage in this economy. And it's going to be essentially the maximum of three types of firms. One is the humans can be in three types of firms. They can be in a firm where there's a single layer. That's going to be WS. There's a firm that is automates the bottom layer, that's WB, and there's a firm that automates the top layer, that's WT. So these are the three possibilities for humans. And in equilibrium, the firm that gets the maximum wage given the rental rate is going to be the one that forms, and that's going to be the resulting wage in the economy. Okay, and the wage in a single layer firm is going to be analogous to a singular firm that hires machines, which is going to be FH. That's a probability that the human by itself knows how to solve the problem. Then we have the wage in a bottom automated firm, which is going to be the whole output we've seen before, minus how much you have to pay, this firm has to pay in terms of machine cost. It's using NN machines, and the rental rate of compute we've seen is FN. So that's going to be that. And finally, what is the wage in a firm that automates the top layer? Well, it's going to be the output, which is going to be the number of humans doing production work at the bottom layer times the probability they solve the problem with the machine help, minus the machine cost, which in this case you're just hiring one machine at the top, so that the machine cost is just Evan. Right? So we have to compare these wages, see which one is higher, and that's going to be the relevant wage in this economy. Okay, so let me give you a picture of in which cases these. So now I'll show you a picture of two-dimensional knowledge, so machine and human knowledge, and we'll see under which conditions the WS is larger than WB or W is larger than WT. Okay, so this is the picture I'm describing. This is two dimensions of knowledge, knowledge dimension one, knowledge dimension two, and we have a point H that's an arbitrary point of human knowledge. That's how much knowledge humans have. Okay? And then on the x-axis we'll be plotting the machine knowledge, and on the y-axis we'll plot the machine knowledge in dimension one, on the y-axis the machine knowledge in dimension two. The red area is a situation where when machines are very close to humans in terms of knowledge, there's not going to be two-layer organizations forming. So both machines and humans will be operating in isolation. They are so close to each other in terms of knowledge that there's no value in communicating. Okay? That's the red area. All the green area around it, it's essentially a situation where machines' knowledge is relatively small in both dimensions relative to humans, and in that case we'll have machines in equilibrium tackling the routine problems, and all humans will be sort of helping those machines that get stuck. Okay, so the green area is bottom automated firms arise when machines. So essentially, let's look at the opposite, and then we'll understand better the green area. What is the blue area? The blue area is a situation where machines are very good in both dimensions, are essentially better than humans in all dimensions. In that case, what's going to happen is humans do the routine work and ask the machines for help. Okay, so here we have the three regions where only single layer firms occur. That's going to be the red area. The firms that occur are machines doing the routine work asking the humans. That's the green area. And the blue area is the one where humans do the routine work and ask machines for help because machines are so much more knowledgeable in both dimensions. Okay? Now, what we want to understand is we'll keep H fixed, we'll keep the knowledge of the humans fixed, and we want to understand how when you change machine knowledge in either dimension, how does that change the labor income of the wage, the equilibrium labor income. Okay? So total output in this economy is the sum of capital income plus labor income. Okay? Capital income is the amount of machine time mu times the rental rate of capital. Labor income is W star. It's the wage because there's only 1 unit of time. So capital income we've already pinned down to be mu times FM. That is increasing in any dimension of machine knowledge. So from these, you can already see how when machine improves in any dimension, FM improves. The probability that the machine can solve a problem by itself is going to be improving. As a result, the capital income is increasing in no matter what dimension machines start with and what dimension they improve in knowledge, capital income will always increase. The question we want to ask is what's going to happen to the marginal product of labor when machine knowledge increases. So the question we want to ask is what's happening to this MPL, the marginal product of labor or labor income, right? So increasing machine knowledge in either dimension will increase output in this economy. It will increase capital income. The question is how does an effect of machine in one dimension or the other will affect labor income? Okay, that's the question we're interested in. It's a fairly basic question, but one that we still didn't know the answer until this paper. Okay, so let me show you the main result, and we call it the Turing Valley for a reason you'll see in a minute. So in equilibrium the wage actually we can differentiate it. So the question is well posed, and if in equilibrium, where in this red area I showed you, where humans are so close to machines that there's no interaction among them in equilibrium, then the wage actually doesn't depend on machine knowledge because there's no interaction between humans and machines in equilibrium. The interesting case is the other case where we're not in that red area. So machines are sufficiently different from humans that there's going to be interaction in equilibrium. When that's the case, this is our main result. It's going to be if you look at the dimension I, either one or two, in which machines know less than humans. So you start with a dimension, whichever you want, where machines know less than humans. What happens when you increase the machine knowledge in that dimension? And the result is that the wage is going to decrease. So when machines become better in dimensions in which they are worse than humans, that actually harms the marginal product of labor, that harms the wage. Right? In contrast, if you increase machine knowledge in a dimension in which the machine is already better than humans, that actually increases the wage, that increases the marginal product of labor. Right? And as a result, you have this is why we call the Turing Valley, because essentially you can recall this famous test of intelligence by Turing, more 75 years ago, that says, okay, what is the Turing test? Well, when is it the case that the machine can imitate the human and you cannot tell the difference? So here, you can see this result as well. Improvements in AI in any given dimension in which AI does not pass the Turing test will reduce labor income. If AI already passes the Turing test in that dimension, improving AI in that dimension increases labor income, right? So let me give you a couple of implications, then I'll conclude and I'll give you some intuition. So again, we have this two-dimensional plot. We have the humans. We have the red area where there's no interaction. As long as machines are sufficiently different from humans, so you're not in the red area, here you see the directions of improvement in wage. So when machines are worse than humans in both dimensions, actually, moving towards humans, improving machines in either dimension will reduce labor income. So if you want to increase labor income, you would have to reduce machine knowledge in both dimensions. If machines, in contrast, are better than humans in dimension one but worse than humans in dimension two, improvements in machine knowledge in dimension one increase labor income, but decreases in M2 will actually increase labor income as well, right? So if you want to If humans are better than machines in dimension two, but you improve machines in the dimension two, that actually harms labor income, right? And we can for the case in which the distribution of problems is uniform, we can plot this labor income right here. Again, this is M1 right here, M2 right here, and here we have the humans somewhere in between, and here we can see how labor income changes as a function of how much the machine knows. And here we can see, well, you have the Turing Valley, right? So it's decreasing as well, the result as I've told you. And here you can already start asking also, under what is the kind of machine knowledge that will maximize labor income? And in this example, what you see is that it's not the machine knowledge that is the best possible knowledge. Actually, in this case, the best machine knowledge or the best kind of AI for labor income is one that knows a lot in one dimension, but very little in the other dimension, right? Why is that? Because when AI knows a lot in one dimension but very little in the other, the price of computing power is very low because the opportunity cost of machine time by itself is very low. But if you combine the machine time with the human, that actually becomes very useful. And because the opportunity cost of machines is determined by what machines can do by themselves, that actually turns out to be worse for output, but better for labor income. Okay, so let me conclude and I'll give you some intuition. So we start by saying, look, the rise of AI implies that machines can become central in the knowledge economy. And what is the key in the knowledge economy? Well, the key in the knowledge economy is that there's this non-codifiable knowledge, and once you have this non-codifiable knowledge, communication is very important. Also, we've said, look, AI's knowledge may not be comparable to human knowledge, so we want to take seriously the idea that knowledge can be multidimensional. So the question that is very natural and we're asking in this paper is, how do AI capabilities shape labor income in a knowledge economy that has many dimensions? And the answer is, well, it's not monotonic. There is this Turing value we've seen, right? So what is the mechanism here? It's actually a new mechanism. So it's not, we have models of automation that lead to lower labor income in some circumstances. But this mechanism is very different. As far as we know, I would be happy to know if this sounds similar to other stuff you've seen. But as far as we know, this is a new mechanism. And what is this mechanism is that non-codifiable knowledge work requires communication. And the question is, well, when AI improves, it's changing the nature of the communication between humans and machines. And the question is, when is the contribution of humans in this communication becomes better? When AI improves in dimension in which AI does not pass the Turing test, in which AI is worse than humans, AI is improving. And all of a sudden, it stops asking the questions that humans know how to answer, and it makes it more likely that the kinds of questions machines ask humans are exactly those that the humans don't know how to answer. That's the intuition behind the result that when AI improves in dimension which is worse than humans, labor income goes down. Why is that? Because the machines stop asking questions that humans were helpful with, and they increasingly ask questions that the human doesn't know the answer to. So the value of communication goes down. As a result, the marginal product of labor goes down. The other side of this result is that when AI becomes better than humans, is better already than humans in one dimension, improvements in machine knowledge in that dimension actually helps the marginal product of labor. Why? Because when AI improves in these dimensions, it actually stops asking questions that the human didn't know how to answer. So the whole mechanism is all about the flow of problems, at what kinds of problems the humans are receiving, and how that changes when with machine knowledge. I've just shown you the main result and the main intuition. In the paper, we do all sorts of extension. We look at, okay, what if there's many humans? Humans are heterogeneous as well, and then you can see how different machine knowledge changes will affect different humans differently. What happens, the benchmark we've been looking at is, okay, machines are abundant. There's always machine doing independent production work. What happens if we relax that? There's interesting things happening there. What happens to AI friendliness? When you can model in this framework as changes in the communication costs. So how does the marginal product of labor changes when you reduce the communication costs? And we're working on other extensions. So thank you so much. And if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.